Welcome to In Deep. I'm Angie Cuero. Even as the death of Trayvon Martin focused attention on Florida's Stand Your Ground law, a gunman took out seven lives at a small university here on the West Coast. Guns are cheap and plentiful, but the NRA is pushing for fewer restrictions and more freedoms to use a gun with no questions asked. Turns out our old friend Alec is at work here too. Guns and the Law, this hour on In Deep. And it's time now for our blogger spotlight. This time around, we're focusing on a disappointing and surprising progressive loss in the state of Illinois. Ryan Grimm and Amanda Turkle wrote this up for the Huffington Post. Here's part of their coverage. After several rounds of painful soul searching, Washington-based progressives compare notes on Ilya Shainman's stunning open primary loss to a fellow Democrat, businessman Brad Schneider, in Illinois' 10th congressional district Tuesday night. Shainman rose through the ranks of MoveOn.org, outraged Schneider, was leading in polls, and had the enthusiastic support of pillars of the online progressive community, yet collapsed in a heap and lost by 8 points. The article goes on to note his significant support from Progressive Change Campaign Committee, Democracy for America, USA Action, Communication Workers of America, MoveOn, and a reported, quote, 600-person army of volunteers. And public polls, both those which may have been somewhat slanted in favor of the progressive and others as well, had him on the way to victory. So is this some unfathomable fluke, or do we have lessons here that we can turn around fast enough to use them in more current progressive campaigns? Mario Piscitella joins me on the line. He is with mpapolitical.com, where he's the progressive Democratic strategist and trainer. Mario, thanks for taking time today.
And thank you for having me. I'd first like to say that Ilya and his staff ran a fantastic campaign. Starting with a young candidate, they overcame that hurdle very quickly. But one of the broader lessons that I take from it is one of the major differences between conservative candidates and progressive candidates, establishment candidates in general and progressive candidates, and that is defining yourself versus defining the race. Ilya's campaign was fantastic at defining Ilya against the conservatives and Ilya against the establishment, but they didn't necessarily define Ilya as a whole. And that allowed his establishment opponent, Brad Schneider, to define Ilya the way he wanted to, which was using the strong Jewish community against Ilya, where he was a Jewish immigrant. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't have been a liability for him, but it is a common failing in progressive candidates. A lot of our progressive candidates are inspired to run out of kind of anger and angst with the opposition, and so they define themselves in that frame of them against the conservative.
Right.
If you go back and look at a lot of Ilya's emails, they target the Republican candidate, and there's a lot of value there, and that should be part of the process, but what wasn't there was a broad and early definition of Ilya. Now, there's reasons for that, too. He didn't have the money. Mm-hmm. Progressive candidates struggled to get the money until the end of the campaign cycle, non-establishment candidates in general. The money came in late, but you can't count on it until it shows up. And so, while all those organizations were backing him at the end, they weren't necessarily providing money at the beginning when it was most important.
And it's hard to plan for money when it comes in at the last moment. You can't do projections. You can't say we have X amount for commercials, we have X amount to feed the volunteers. There's no planning that can be done.
Correct. We basically budget campaigns backwards. We start from Election Day and work towards where we are today. And so the money at the end is what's most important to spend to get the voters to show up. But if you don't have the money to build the voter base, then who are you getting to show up? And so those are struggles we deal with, and we need to do better at raising the money earlier.
Yeah, one of the things that when Daily Coast columnists were analyzing this and putting in their own perspectives, bold progressives wrote that progressive congressional candidates, the candidate lost, while other candidates got 14% of the vote, he only got 8%. And his summary was nobody voted. And I bring that up almost as a personal note because my big fear is complacency and not enough get out the vote effort. Do you really think that was a problem here? And can you address the whole get out the vote problem in the larger scale?
Turnout was certainly lower than we would have expected or liked it to have been. But again, this is all resources, and where Ilya had motivated a lot of grassroots support early, as his opponent started dumping money into negative ad campaigns and things like that, that peels that support down. And that, it appears at this point, I don't have all the information, I wasn't inside of the campaign, it appears to have had a significant impact on Ilya's turnout.
Mm. So as we move toward the presidential election, and even in future elections, maybe if more progressives are inclined to run, how do they learn how to do this so as not to create the same mistakes? And we've got about 40 seconds for your answer.
The first answer I would give is to learn and hire professionals, not necessarily the top name you can find, but the people that actually have the talent and the wisdom. I start with DFA training. I'm a DFA trainer. I'm proud of that. The DFA training manual is the first thing any potential candidate should look at to understand what a campaign should look like.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, it's making sure that you have people that you trust working with you that actually do know what they're doing, that they aren't making up as they're going on. There is science to this. It's not just magic.
Mario Piscitello, that's brilliant information. I thank you for spending the time with us, and we'll put links up to your website at mpapolitical.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mario Piscitelli is progressive Democratic strategist and trainer with MPA Political. Find out more about the show, including how to support us, at indeepradio.com. We're on Facebook as In Deep with Angie Coiro. Follow us on Twitter at In Deep Radio. I'm Angie Coiro. This is In Deep. Unfortunately, the topic of guns comes back again and again and again. We've spent a lot of time here on the talk of Trayvon Martin, the Florida Stand Your Ground law that in some eyes excuses George Zimmerman from what he has allegedly done. And now, of course, here in the San Francisco Bay Area, we had an absolutely dismal occurrence over the past week, and that was a very deliberate shooting that led to multiple deaths at Oikos University, a very small, not very well-known college in the town of Oakland. And the gentleman caught in nearby Alameda afterward does not seem to have evinced any sorrow at all about what he's done. There are some different reports coming out as to what his motivation might have been. There are different guesses as to which person he might have been targeting. But the one thing that isn't questionable is that this damage was done, as so many times is the case, with a gun. You will always have imbalanced individuals. You will always have people who will take up some kind of armament and go on the attack. It is undeniable that had he gone to that campus with a knife, had he gone to that campus with a stick, had he gone to the campus with anything but a gun, you wouldn't have so many deaths in such rapid succession. But of course, the NRA exists in America, so every effort that we see being made in the legislatures, be it a state or a federal legislature, to try to restrain the availability of guns, restrain the accessories that allow people to fire their guns more rapidly, or to fire them silently, or to fire more lethal bullets, you can count on the NRA to show up and say, hey, you're infringing on my Second Amendment right, and I'm not going to let that happen. So we're spending this hour talking about gun violence and the NRA. How do they work? Who are they really? And how do we fight back against them? And as we look into this story, we find a connection to yet another topic we carry with some frequency, and that's Alec. You know all about Alec from our friend Spocko. He wrote a wonderful introduction on our site at indeepradio.com, and I encourage you to go take a look at that. Cliff Schechter joins us now to draw these two points together. Cliff Schechter is a public relations strategist, founder and president of a progressive PR firm called Libertas. He's the author of 2008's The Real McCain, and he is the co-owner and founder of We Act Radio in Washington, D.C. Cliff, thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much, Andy. How are you?
I am well. Thank you very much. So we've heard a lot about Alec. We know that they stay behind the scenes and write these laws that, lo and behold, tend to turn up as Republican legislation across the country. Draw the line together for me between Alec and the NRA and the Trayvon Martin case.
Well, sure. And thanks for giving me the opportunity. Look, Alec has what they've done. They were founded in 1973 by Paul Weyrich. Right around the time, in fact, the exact same year, the Heritage Foundation was founded, and a number of other very right wing organizations, with the goal of pretty much enforcing their view of the way things should be on the rest of us. You know, whether it happened democratically or not didn't really matter. Paul Weyrich is somebody who was quoted as saying also, the fewer people voted, the better it was for them. We know what they mean by that.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, what you've got with Alec is you've got this secretive organization, corporate funded. That's where 98-99% of their funding comes from. Legislators join too, state legislators, for example. They have to pay about $50 each. the big corporations that join have to pay more, like anywhere between $25,000, $50,000, sometimes upwards of $100,000. And, you know, and they get their legislation. So, for example, if you want to go and you want to, you're an organization, insurance company, others, you want to go buy yourself tort reform, you go and you go to ALEC meetings, you sit down. I mean, basically what it does is it's a way of laundering legislation. It's probably the best way to put it. They get legislators, right-wing legislators, in a room with people with a lot of money at these swanky hotels and spas and events. They give them direct access to each other where these guys can lobby them over all sorts of free stuff they're being given. So, you know, often you know, a lot of these legislators could be from small towns and places where they've never seen anything like this. And essentially, you know, ALEC foots the bill for all this. Well, really, the corporate guys that pay them off do. And so they facilitate these meetings. And the NRA is no different. I've tried to often point out to people that you need to look at the NRA the way you look at Wall Street firms, big pharma. Yeah, the NRA, since they had something called the Cincinnati Revolt in 1977, the hard right, you know, hard right wingers took over. They no longer have been about sporting and hunting. They use that as a cover. But what they are is they're a front for the arms dealers. I mean, that's essentially what they are. Gun manufacturers who really are just nothing but arms dealers because they want to be able to sell to anybody at any time, anywhere. That's their agenda. The NRA used the NRA and the goodwill the NRA built up over years before this takeover as a front group. And the number of people from some of the big gun gun manufacturers are on ALEC's board. Are on the NRA's board. The NRA is on ALEC's board, and it gets a little mixed up here. But essentially what you're looking at is the NRA having a lot of influence with ALEC, and that's where you get the gun laws from, just the way you get the tort reform laws and the voter suppression laws and the other things. Right-wing organizations have an interest in this, and ALEC is how they do it. And they've been mostly secretive till now. I think really the last couple of years, this whole thing has just been getting more exposed. And so that's what happened here. They met with the NRA in 2005, ALEC did, and the NRA wanted to push the Stand Your Ground legislation, which, mind you, really the only purpose here is to sell more guns and is to create a society where everyone's carrying, everyone feels threatened, and therefore they sell more guns that way. There's no other purpose to it. Under common law, you already had the right to self-defense. The only assumption was that if you could safely retreat, you would, which is what you'd think you would do in a civilized society. Not if retreating meant harm to you, just if you safely could. Well, this takes away that responsibility, so now somebody looks somewhat different than you in your gated community and is suspicious from your point of view, you get to shoot them. And again, this is all part of a broad cultural change that financially is a windfall for them because the number of people who own guns has been going down dramatically. Okay, that's one of the reasons they've also used Obama as a rallying point, racism and fear of him taking away guns, even though all he's done with respect to that issue is expand where you can take guns to national parks and on your luggage and Amtrak since he's been in office.
In fact, I want to let our listeners know that in our next segment, we're going to be talking to Robert Spitzer about how the NRA is approaching this decline in gun ownership. So just to let you know, that's coming up. And Cliff, please go on.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, actually, Robert Spitzer, he wrote a brilliant piece, I think it was for Salon recently, where he pointed this out. You know, it's about half of those over 70 own guns. I think it was his numbers that I'm even using here. Of those 18 to 29, I think it's about 17%. So it goes way down. And so really what they need to do is to convince a much smaller pool of people to buy many more guns. The way you do that is you invent exotic new ones that can shoot more bullets and shoot armor-piercing bullets and do other things that excite the members of this sort of gun cult who are obsessed with guns. That's one way you do it. The way to do it is, well, you know, if you can block background checks at gun shows and things, then you can sell to criminals and those who are mentally unstable. Hell, that's a whole other market of people that you can sell to. So whenever they try to claim they want to enforce all the laws in the books and they don't want, they do what they can to stop criminals from getting guns, I'm not going to use a nice word for this. It's a lie. They are simply lying. If they can sell guns to you, me, you know, the Son of Sam killer and Ayman al-Zawahiri, it doesn't really matter which of us they sell to. It's money. All of us who buy them are money for them.
One of the uglier words that has to come up when you're talking the Trayvon Martin case, and there's no dancing around it, is the element of racism. And you touch on that in your article for Al Jazeera that we're going to link from our page. You wrote up the link between ALEC and NRA for the Al Jazeera site. And it's been brought up time and again that what happened with Trayvon Martin, if you had reversed the roles, if a young black man had killed a white child, he certainly wouldn't have walked away free that night. He certainly wouldn't have walked away with his concealed carry permit still intact. And as you trace it through the article that you've written, is that Alec has that same dismal racial element to it, to where the legislation that they put out works to disenfranchise racial minorities at the ballot box. There are a lot of their goals are to disenfranchise both racial minorities and the lower classes.
That's exactly right. I mean, everything they do is intricately tied into racism. If they can scare people that, you know, not just in gated communities, but whether it be working class, middle class neighborhoods, and anywhere else for that matter, that there are hordes of threatening African American men coming to attack you, that they can get everybody to buy guns. I mean, it's very simply what this is about. Really, that someone who has often been ahead of their time and was on this was Michael Moore in Bowling for Columbine, who pointed out that yes, one of the big reasons that we have such trouble in this country is our gun laws. But it's not just that; it's all the people that prey on fear and use racial coding to get people to buy these guns to scare them. And this is what the NRA does. This is what they do when they call Obama a trained communist and he's coming to get your guns. And what ends up happening, but a man named Richard Poplawski in Pittsburgh, when three policemen show up because there's a warrant on him, assumes that because he's mentally unstable too, and he's got his hands on a gun, assumes that these guys are coming from being sent by President Obama, and he shoots all three of them and kills them. I mean, this has real world effects, real world implications, and the Stand Your Ground law is nothing if not that. Mm-hmm. Another important point, and you'll be talking to your next guest about this too, of course, are concealed carry laws. And that's just revolutionized everything, just like the Stand Your Ground laws. You know, it's given people a false sense of the history of this country, which is easy to do because everybody thinks of the Wild West and how things used to be, when the truth of the matter is that, you know, all you have to do is rent a copy of Tombstone and see it accurately portrayed, that in Wyatt Earp's, Wild West, you checked your guns at the edge of town. You didn't bring them into the bar with you, which you now can do in the state of Ohio here and I think about 22 other states. You didn't take them into town and you checked them there.
Because we all know that alcohol and guns mix very, very well.
Right. and it's just like next time you feel like shooting up heroin and going boating. Those are things that go very well together. seriously, you're exactly right. I mean, they knew that. They were responsible about guns. They knew that when you're out in the Wild West and when you're out in between towns, you might encounter things you need a gun to protect yourself, fine. But realizing that in cities, towns, and other places, where there are people, where there's civilization, that guns are simply going to lead to more people dying. And that's the argument that needs to be made. And so, again, all this is tied in together, though. The concealed carry mentality is also about, I need to have my gun because anytime somebody might attack me, and that is also a play on racism. And what I tried to point out in my article is that it's not surprising at all, because, I mean, Alec, what they do is racist to its core, just like what the NRA does. You know, what Alec does is they support voter suppression laws. I mean, they're the ones who've been passing and enforcing, pushing these laws around the country to their different various legislators. They support tort reform, which has just been shown to hurt those who are minority and poor at every turn.
So, you've helped us to draw this line out so well, and I really appreciate it. The music's behind us, so we got to go. But I'm going to point more people to your article. I'm really glad you wrote it, and I'm glad you could take some time for us. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me on, Angie.
Cliff Schechter, we will link to his websites at our website, indeepradio.com. More coming up on this same topic here on In Deep, so stick around.
A young cowboy named Billy Joe grew restless on the farm. A boy filled with wanderlust who really meant no harm. He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down. And his mother cried as he walked out, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "You're Billy Joe's a man. I can shoot as quick and straight as anybody can. But I wouldn't shoot without a cause. I'd gun nobody down. But she cried again as he rolled away. Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town. He sang a song as on he rode, his guns hung at his hips. He rode into a cattle town, a smile upon his lips. He stopped and walked into a bar and laid his money down. But his mother's words echoed again. Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town. He drank his first strong liquor then to calm his shaking hand. And tried to tell himself at last he had become a man. A dusty cowpoke at his side.
This is In Deep. I'm Angie Carro. We're spending this hour talking about guns, of course, with the Oikos University shooting in Oakland, the ongoing conflict over the Stand Your Ground legislation in Florida that's come to light with the Trayvon Martin case. We've just talked with Cliff Schechter about the connections here with ALEC and the NRA. We're going to probe a little more deeply into the NRA, how they manifest their presence in legislative areas, what their history is, and what they really want when they say they want only reasonable gun control laws. We bring on now Dr. Robert Spitzer. He's Distinguished Service Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department at State University of New York Cortland Campus. He's the author of four books on gun control, including the recently published fifth edition of The Politics of Gun Control. And Robert Spitzer, welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you.
I think what stood out to me about your Salon article, which is why I called you, the article that you'd written for Salon magazine, was the fact that fewer Americans, right across the top of the article, fewer Americans own guns now than in the 1960s. That fact is in opposition to the impression I think a lot of us have that so many people are walking around armed. You never know who's got a concealed carry permit next to you at the Starbucks. It kind of defies conventional wisdom that fewer people actually have guns and own them.
Well, I think you're right. A lot of people are surprised that gun ownership is not as prevalent or popular as it used to be. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, about half of all Americans owned at least one gun. Today, that number is about a third, really closer to about 30%. Now, that's still a lot of Americans. Someplace around 80 million Americans own a gun. But all of the attention that's been given, just as you point out, to the spread of concealed carry handgun laws, laws that have been liberalized to make it easier for people to get handgun permits and carry concealed handguns around with them in society, the Stand Your Ground laws, the one in Florida in particular that has gotten so much attention, and 25 states have now enacted these new Stand Your Ground laws over the last few years, it does give the impression that there's kind of this spreading and proliferating gun activity, and there are certainly people who are picking up gun habits and going out to get guns when they did not before own them, but that's a very small number. Most people who own guns and use guns do so because it was a tradition that was passed through the family. A person who owns a gun today, one or more guns today, is very likely to have come from a family where probably the father owned and used guns, and that tradition was passed down. And we know that that tradition is not being passed down to the same degree, and that is one important reason for the gradual decline in gun ownership. And other reasons, too. One is that most people who own guns do so for hunting and sporting purposes and own long guns, rifles and shotguns. A far smaller number of Americans own handguns or handguns exclusively. And if you get a handgun, your most likely stated purpose is to own a handgun for personal self-protection. And that's really where the flurry of activity has been. And that also gets to the political activities behind the liberalization of these gun laws. So there is more kind of gun activity, and we're seeing political activity. We are seeing people who are walking around with handguns and with permits, but it's not happening as much as it seems, and it's really more the political fallout from it and political force behind it that I think gets our attention.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that political fallout, because you can't suggest any regulation, be it what accessories are appropriate to have for a gun, what age one can have for a gun, how you need to store guns in your house, where they can be stored. You can't suggest any of those regulations without the NRA becoming involved. You cannot have an apolitical discussion on these things. The NRA is primarily a gun manufacturer's lobby, is it not? Is it really more than that?
Well, it is more than that, but you're certainly right in emphasizing its important tie to the gun industry. The NRA has long served as the political mouthpiece for gun manufacturers. In fact, gun manufacturers and companies didn't really have their own lobbyists at all until around 20 years ago or a little more. The NRA promotes gun products in their magazines and their advertising, and of course, gun dealers, gun sellers promote NRA membership and have NRA literature readily available. So there's been a long and very close connection between them. But the NRA history, historically, really kind of evolved into that relationship, although it has long had ties with gun manufacturers. The NRA was formed way back in 1871 by two Civil War veterans who had noticed something that military commanders noticed readily, which was that the typical American draft-eligible or military-eligible male didn't know one end of a gun from another. Also, contrary to the typical assumption that the average adult male owned a gun, knew guns, knew how to use guns, and that really wasn't the case. So the NRA was formed to improve marksmanship in 1871, and it emphasized those sorts of shooting and sporting activities for many decades. Interest in hunting evolved later, and the NRA, as a really sharp and harsh and hard-edged political organization, really didn't take off until the 1970s, when a dissident, very hard-right wing of the NRA took control, and then really began to spend more time, money, resources on its political agenda. So its connection to the gun industry has always been there, but its politics, I think, extends today certainly beyond gun manufacturers, although the NRA also knows that its core base of support is gun owners. And if gun ownership is declining, then that means its base over the long haul is contracting as well. And so that certainly brings the two of them together.
I'm curious about this impetus in the 1970s for this to swing right. It's one thing for someone to try to take an organization to the right. It's another for them to succeed. Was this a response to the civil rights movement? Was there something else going on that allowed that to proceed?
Well, the NRA in the 1960s and early 70s had been controlled by a mainstay faction that began to become involved in politics in the 1960s in a significant way, when Congress considered and ultimately passed some gun control legislation. Probably the most important modern gun control law was indeed passed in 1968. It was called the Gun Control Act of that year, and the NRA representatives testified before Congress, lobbied, etc., and supported parts of the bill but opposed other parts and lobbied for changes. But that part of the organization, those who led it at that time, were not quite as politically astute, perhaps, had an interest in politics, but also retained a strong interest in the outdoorsman, hunting, sporting tradition. And they had actually planned to move the headquarters from the NRA from Washington, D.C. to Colorado. And the more hard-right political wing was alarmed at that in the extreme, feeling that gun owners and gun rights were under siege. And in 1977, at the NRA's annual convention, this sort of hard-right faction won control of the organization, and that's when it really began its push to the right, where it escalated its anti-government rhetoric, where it was talking more and more about freedom and political values, about the Second Amendment, and began to de-emphasize the traditional hunting, sporting kinds of activities that had always been the mainstay of the organization, although they continue to be a part of that organization.
Talking with Professor Robert Spitzer about the evolution of the NRA and gun control arguments in the U.S., we've got a link up to some of his books at our website, most notably the fifth edition of The Politics of Gun Control. We also have a link to his article at Salon, The NRA's Silent Motive. We'll take a little bit of a break here and come on back to discuss more of this with Robert Spitzer. I'm Angie Correa. This is In Deep. In Deep Radio is a production of Talkback Media. We are supported in part by our listeners. Talkback Media produces discussions on key political, social, and cultural issues, available for live, digital, audio, and video venues. Learn more online at indeepradio.com. And if you are in a position to help us keep on the air, click one of the PayPal links on the side of the page. One-time gifts or a small monthly donation, whatever works for you. We appreciate it. Thanks. Continuing our conversation with Robert Spitzer on the politics of gun control, the history of the NRA, and the fight now over various gun control issues that have come up in the wake of the Trayvon Martin shooting, and even more recent, unfortunate than that, in the Oikos University shooting in Oakland. Can we probe a little bit, Robert Spitzer, the definition of the Second Amendment and the effect that the NRA has had over those arguments over the years? It's funny that you mentioned to me that the NRA got its start in the Civil War era trying to teach people how to use guns. And now, of course, there's the idea that the right to bear arms applies to the individual in his or her own, and as opposed to a militia. How much influence has the NRA had on that argument and the definition as it's perceived in the American mind?
Well, you raise a very important issue. The NRA has had a very big impact on how Americans see this right to bear arms that's referenced in the Second Amendment. It has, in recent decades, talked endlessly in its literature about this right to bear arms and how it pertains to every citizen, how it's a personal right, and so on. But it was never that in law, not until 2008. Historically, in the courts, in legislation, the Second Amendment was understood to reference citizen service in a militia. After all, the Second Amendment says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And through past court decisions and the general consensus of historians was that was all about a citizen's right to keep and bear arms, but in connection with service in a government-organized and regulated militia. The Supreme Court did an about-face in 2008 in the very important Heller Supreme Court decision, where the court became the first court in history to say that the Second Amendment is a personal right, that is, not tied to militias per se. And that, of course, was seen as a great victory for the NRA, although the NRA, in fact, did not want that court challenge to go ahead because they were terrified that it wouldn't come out their way. And it was actually other conservative forces that were the mainstay in pushing that case to the Supreme Court. But once the court handed down its ruling, I mean, the NRA participated in the briefing and so on, it enshrined this right. Although it also was pretty clear, that is, the Supreme Court was, in saying that traditional gun regulations would be presumptively constitutional, and that has really encompassed most of the laws that we know today. But like any time an interest group can attach itself to the Constitution, it wants to do that, because we enshrine our Constitution, we hold it up high, and the phrase right to bear arms is in the Second Amendment. The fact that it's generally been an ahistorical or unhistorical understanding of that amendment is part of the, I would say, hype around this subject.
How open is the NRA in terms of, I'm trying to figure out the best way to put this. My perception as an admittedly biased person is that they spout the right that one has to have sports arms, to have arms to defend oneself, you know, to be able to be safe in the street and to carry a gun into a situation that might be dangerous, while what they're doing without really verbalizing it is defending the right to have all kinds of accessories and magazines and, you know, cop killer bullets. Basically, everything's okay in the pursuit of having freedoms of guns, freedoms of armament. Is that an unfair characterization?
Well, I think you're pretty close to how the NRA poses itself with respect to gun laws today. That is, the NRA in the modern era pretty much has opposed every gun law that you could think of. I would list one very small exception, which was after the Virginia Tech shooting in 2007, Congress passed a law to regularize the reporting of certain kinds of data involving people who have had mental problems. And the NRA actually joined with pro-gun control forces at that one moment to iron out that law at the federal level. But that was a count of one where it participated in that kind of activity. Generally speaking, the NRA has been against any kind of gun law that involves any kind of restrictions. And while the NRA says that we don't need more laws, we need better enforcement of existing laws, that's really disingenuous because they work feverishly to repeal existing laws, to weaken existing laws, and perhaps even more importantly, to limit the ability to properly administer existing laws. And that's one reason why the NRA has focused so much of its ire and venom on the federal agency that carries out gun laws, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. And as a result of the NRA's relentless attacks on that agency, it's underfunded, it's understaffed, there are all sorts of restrictions on how it can conduct inspections and how often, and it's an agency that has a very difficult time doing its job, largely thanks to the relentless attacks by the NRA. So they're not really interested in existing laws being carried out better. They're more interested in existing laws either being repealed or watered down or carried out badly.
I know that periodically a group will pop up and say, we are supportive of guns. We like to go out hunting and shooting, but we're not supportive of the NRA. In 2008, the American Hunters and Shooters came to light, and they saw themselves as a challenge to the NRA. My question to you is there dissonance within the NRA? Are there occasional voices that are heard in the outside that says, hey, I'm here to own a gun. I'm here to do skeet shooting. I'm not interested in making sure people can have carbines at home.
Well, there have been dissident voices within the NRA in the past. There was, of course, the big dispute within the NRA back in 1977 between the more moderate and the more radical elements. And there have been subsequent sort of internal disputes within the organization. But the NRA has also alienated a lot of gun owners and gun users who engage in traditional, you know, hunting, sporting, and other activities, but who also understand that guns are dangerous and that it's a good thing if people are required to demonstrate some skill, some expertise before they get a gun. And that there, you know, that there are certain kinds of weapons that really ought not to be available to civilians because they're pretty exotic and unusually destructive. And when you burrow past the instinctive revulsion to the phrase gun control among people in the gun community, what I found is that you really do get a much wider array of opinions about what the government should be doing. And it doesn't help anybody to have people running around and shooting people willy-nilly or using guns irresponsibly. So that's one reason why you want to have sensible gun laws, as is often said. But those voices are not as well organized as the NRA, which really, in political terms, has been extremely effective over the years in advancing its political goals and doing other things to be kind of the top dog among gun groups.
Robert Spitzer, this has been very illuminating. I appreciate you taking time with us.
Well, it's very good to speak with you.
Robert Spitzer, whose fifth edition of The Politics of Gun Control is out now from Paradigm Publishers. We have a list of his other publications and a link to his page at the Political Science Department at SUNY Cortland, where he's Distinguished Service Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department. You'll find all that at indeepradio.com.
We like our flat-screen TVs, we like our internet, and we like to fill our houses with whatever we can get. We like our weekend parties, we like to have our fun, most of all, we love our guns. Well, we like to fly in airplanes, travel far and wide. We like a brand new car, we like a fast, smooth ride. We like our beer cold, we like to have more than one. Most of all, we love our guns. For we like a Republican Party. Keep the U.S. strong. We like to wave our flag. We like our country, right or wrong. We like to flex our muscles. Like the wars we've won. Most of all, we love our guns. Well, they say that guns don't really kill us, just the people with a will. And they say a gun can't shoot itself. They're right. Only people can shoot themselves with a gun. Say don't blame the revolver. Don't blame the rifle. Blame the Bill of Rights. It's in the Bible. King James Version. Well, there's lots of bad things people do, like taking drugs and sniffing glue, getting in fights at honky-tonk bars, trying to make kids porn stars. These things are illegal to do, and maybe guns ought to be too.
We're talking this hour about guns, about the NRA, about gun violence, and this time around, in this segment, we're going to talk about what happens to gun legislation when it finally gets to the floor of Congress? We know that there are often incidents like the one at Oikos that we've been talking about today that get people alarmed. They want to do something. They contact their legislators, and their legislators in some cases are responsive and try to draft legislation that will tackle the problem of too many guns in too many hands with not enough discretion. So what becomes of those bills when they finally hit the floor? Led Everett is pretty steeped in this stuff. He's director of communication for the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. We're going to put a link to that up on our website, which is at indeepradio.com. We're also putting up a link to an important page that they have called meetthenra.org. Led Everett, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Am I mistaken, or is it true that even when we don't have a shootout in the headlines at the moment, as we do right now, more often than not, Americans, when they're polled, they want some reasonable control over who gets guns, how fast, and what guns they can get. Is that right? I mean, that's the popular sentiment.
That is true, yeah. I mean, there's a little bit of a dichotomy in the polling. You know, when you ask Americans, should we have stricter gun control, the numbers are certainly not as strong now as they were, you know, three decades ago, 2 decades ago, or even 10 years ago. But when you drill down to asking people about specific policies, such as should we have background checks on all gun sales, or should we have better regulation at gun shows, should we block people on the terrorist watch list from buying guns, there you still see overwhelming majorities of Americans and even gun owners saying, yes, absolutely, we should have better controls. I think the NRA has had success in demonizing the term gun control, but when you actually get down to the level of policy, the support among the American people is as strong as ever for enacting better laws.
One of the things that I think is pretty well established about the NRA, and we've talked with our earlier guest about this, is what their public policies are as they state them, and then the records that they show when it gets down to actual legislation. The NRA is not going to come out and say anybody who's an adult can have pretty much any gun and any gun accessory at any time, and we don't want you to stand in the way of that. They're not saying that publicly, but let's talk about how they manifest that on the floor of the Congress, of the Houses of Congress. When the NRA is making its influence felt through the lobbyists, is it true, and I don't want to be unfair to them, is it true that they essentially go after any gun control in the name of not starting a slippery slope?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think you have to understand their primary motivation. The NRA is very closely tied in with the gun industry. They have leaders in the gun industry sitting on their board. It's at the level where when you go to buy a gun, in many cases, you're going to have an NRA membership slip in the box in which you buy the gun. If you go attend a gun show, the fee to get in might automatically enroll you in the NRA. Gun sellers have roundup programs where you can round up the change on a gun buy and give the roundup to the next dollar to the NRA. So they are very intimately tied with the industry, and the object of everything that the NRA does is to sell more guns. It's no different than fights that Americans have had in the past against the tobacco lobby, the pharmaceutical lobby, or any other major lobby. This is an industry, and their primary goal in all these measures, the common thread in all of them, is to sell more guns. It's profit.
Well, let's talk, for example, then, about the gun shows. And let me let some of our listeners on the East Coast know what's happening over here on the San Francisco side of the world. Even this week, there's an ongoing battle about what is sold at gun shows and where they can be held. There is a county here, Alameda County, that says you can't be holding gun shows at our fairgrounds. We don't want gun shows at the fairgrounds. And gun owners and gun merchandisers have gone after that in court. And just earlier this week, a federal appeals court in San Francisco said, all right, you guys got to go to mediation over this. The court's not going to come down on behalf of either the gun merchants nor of the county. They're sending them off to mediation. And that's just the latest in an ongoing battle to see if you can sell guns on county property around here. I guess that my question with that on a nationwide basis is that access to guns doesn't really seem to be an issue. There are plenty of merchants. We don't see any evidence on the street that people can't get guns if they want them. So how does the NRA couch its arguments that, you know, gun shows across the country need to be so unfettered?
Well, the NRA has adopted essentially what we call an insurrectionist premise where they oppose gun laws, arguing that, even the most modest of gun laws, could create some slippery slope where the government eventually establishes lists of gun holders and then goes to their homes and forcibly takes their guns. It's this notion the NRA has that gun owners must stockpile firearms against our government and prepare for war with them. When you've adopted that type of insurrectionist ideology, even the most, modest gun regulation proposal, like, let's say, reporting lost and stolen guns, could seem suspect. We think that that's both a tremendous perversion of our Constitution and incredibly dangerous. And, when you take it to a level of public policy, it makes for awful policy. And the result is in that the overwhelming majority of states in this country, you have private sellers, individuals who are theoretically at least not engaged in the business of dealing firearms, coming out to these gun shows every weekend and selling guns totally unregulated. They're not required by law to conduct background checks, and they're not required by law to keep records of sale. So if and when their guns end up on crime scenes, it becomes near impossible for law enforcement to trace these guns because there's simply no paper trail to do so. And they might be able to trace that gun back to the original retail sale. But, that gun at that point could have been transferred 1, 2, 3, 5, 10 times through these private exchanges with just no paper trail whatsoever to follow. So, again, this type of insurrectionist ideology, we can't have the government monitoring the transfer of firearms among individuals, has created a nightmare for law enforcement in this country.
Ladd Everett is Director of Communication for the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. You can find their website at csgv.org. You're talking about trying to get some of the regulations into the form of law so that it can help to deal with the gun violence. And one of the things your website deals with is microstamping. And microstamping seems to be something that no one of a sane mind could argue with. What you're saying is not, you're slapping more restrictions on ownership. You're saying that the guns used in a violent crime ought to leave more of a mark, ought to be more fingerprinted. It should be easier to find out, where the bullet came from. How does the NRA couch its opposition to microstamping?
Well, they throw everything but the kitchen sink at it. Some of the stuff that they throw at it is basically saying that they claim that tests have proven that the technology won't work. But even the most critical studies done by individuals who are pretty hostile to gun regulation show that the technology would work, 70-75% of the time. The current system, the IBIS system, only successfully identifies a crime gun 1.5% of the time. So even the most critical studies of microstamping show that it would be exponentially, astronomically more effective than the kind of 1950s, 1960s technology we're still using today, which, people who watch CIS, I think, would be shocked
to see how we investigate gun crimes today. It's quite frankly embarrassing. It's Stone Age type technology. But again, what this really harkens back to is this type of insurrectionist ideology. The real reason they don't want this is they do not want gun owners to be more accountable for guns that end up on crime scenes. That's really what this is about. They oppose micro stamping for the same exact reason they oppose the regulation of private sales of firearms, where there's no background checks and no records of sale, for the same reason they oppose the reporting of lost and stolen guns. They want individuals to be able to transfer firearms without any accountability whatsoever. And that very well could mean transferring a gun to the guy that beat his wife, a guy that has a felony record, a guy that's severely mentally ill, et cetera, et cetera. And again, this type of ideology, this ideology that we must allow people to stockpile firearms against their own government without any oversight or monitoring, is unbelievably, it's not just dangerous to our democracy, but it's also led to just awful gun policy written by the gun lobby that has made law enforcement's job an absolute nightmare.
You mentioned the danger of getting guns and ammunition to the hands of the mentally ill. I don't want to jump to any conclusions as to what happened with the Oikos University shooter in Oakland. There are indications the man is not entirely right in the head. Apparently hasn't evinced any remorse that people are dead at the end of his gun. But it does bring up that issue of trying to keep guns away from people who shouldn't have them. I was having a conversation online with a number of like-minded people, and I said, this is an ideal argument for why the NRA pushes too far. And their response was intriguing to me. The response I got was, look, the rational answer the NRA is going to give you to that is California is already so heavily regulated that if the California laws can't keep a gun out of the hands of a guy like this, then regulation doesn't work anyway. And I think that we hear that from the NRA a lot. The regulation doesn't work anyway. If you want a gun, you're going to get a gun. Where does that fall apart?
Well, number one, I think it's a tad premature to figure out where the shooter in this instance got his gun. The reports are that he is saying that he got the gun from a Bay Area gun shop and supposedly it was a legal sale. The shop he's named, Bullseye, has not confirmed that. And they have not, as far as I'm aware, this might have changed very recently, found the crime gun yet. He disposed of it and will not tell them where he disposed of it. Many of California's crime guns come from outside states where private sales are perfectly legal. One high-profile example would be the shooter who traveled from California to the Pentagon and shot a security guard at the Pentagon not too long ago, and that was an individual that got his gun, could not get a gun in California, so went to a gun show in Nevada and got one there through a private sale. So, we'll have to see how this shakes out with this shooter. But I think in terms of mental health, the big issue there is people need to understand that federal disqualifications for gun purchasers in terms of mental health reasons have not been updated in this country since 1968. So we've gone now nearly 50 years without taking a new look at that. And the federal disqualifications for gun purchasers for mental health reasons are very narrow. The only sets of people that would be prohibited for mental health reasons from buying a gun are people who have been involuntarily committed to a psychiatric institution, basically forced to go into one, or people who have been formally adjudicated by a court as what was known in the law as a mental defective, basically a danger to themselves or others. And there are many people who are severely mentally ill and a danger to themselves or others who have never been under either of those situations. They've never been in an institution. They've never come before a court. In many cases, they've never so much as even sought treatment. So we have laws on the books today, unfortunately, at a federal level and in many states that do not take a very descriptive look at someone's mental health background. And I think that at the end of the day, and again, it's still speculation because we have a lot to learn, that this university shooter might fall into that category. This might have been a gentleman who was very mentally ill, and we have some suggestions from his fellow students that there were obviously issues there, and you just don't line up people one day and start shooting them randomly. Obviously, this guy had serious issues, but I think it might be a case where he had mental health issues but simply had never been, quote-unquote, in the system. Mm-hmm. And therefore, because there's no tighter look at him, he was able to buy a gun. And I think another another level of this that needs to be looked at, and that I hope California will look at, is that as part, again, assuming he legally bought this gun and underwent a background check, as part of the licensing process for handgun owners in California, you know, what is the scrutiny there for mental health above and beyond what the federal check requires, which is very shallow, and does California need to revisit its own state regulations in that area in terms of their investigation on mental health at the state level? And again, it's a bit premature to have this conversation until all the information is in.
Yeah, understandably enough, that makes sense. Yeah, I do want to draw some attention to your website, meetthenra.org. And one of the more important pages on there is to get people acquainted with Marion Hammer, who used to be the president of the NRA, and currently she's lobbying for the NRA. And I think she's of particular interest right now because of the profile of the Trayvon Martin shooting. And she's in favor of the Stand Your Ground law, which has come under great, great scrutiny because of this. And she's the NRA lobbyist who was behind this law in the Florida State Legislature. So how has she reacted to the Trayvon Martin shooting? And if I may add, it does appear that George Zimmerman still had his concealed carry permit, even though there had been questions about a violent incident in his past. So, you know, again, seeing some flaws there. How has she been defending what's been happening there?
Well, I mean, her basic claim is, you know, essentially what happens is whenever there's a horrific mass shooting by a concealed handgun permit holder, and I think we need to keep in mind that they're not rare. For example, in 2009, there were 6 confirmed mass shootings, 3 or more people killed by people who were legally carrying guns in public. Jared Loughner, of course, in Tucson was legally carrying a handgun in public. So I think the gun lobby's typical response is whenever one of their people does something like this, they just try to immediately throw that person under the bus and be like, well, this person was just evil, or this was an aberration and there's nothing wrong with the law. And that's essentially what Marion Hammer is claiming, even though Trayvon Martin is by far from the first unarmed Floridian to be killed under this law. There have been many. He's not even the first black unarmed teenager to be killed under the Stand Your Ground law in Florida, much less the first person. So, you know, her response has basically been what it typically is when she, is called into criticism, and it's shove it. She's, basically said, you know, if Governor Scott wants to investigate this law, you know, he can have fun, or, you know, let him have a crack at it. But, I mean, the basic underlying message there is that, I'm coming to fight you if you challenge this. So that's pretty much what we expected from her. That's pretty much always been the tack that she's taken. She's been unbelievably insulting to anyone who's had a problem with these laws, describing them as quote unquote criminal coddlers, suggesting our country would be better if we got rid of all the liberals and whatnot. So this, she is not a person that has respect for those who disagree with her politically or who are concerned about the loss of life being caused by some of these laws, which really the whole world acknowledges are both dangerous and immoral.
Well, it's good to have her voice of compassion on the record. Vlad Everett, I really thank you for shedding some light on this for us, and we will direct people to your websites, plural, at csgv.org and meetthenra.org. Thanks so much for the work that you do.
Thanks for having me.
Vlad Everett, Director of Communication with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Coming up on the next hour of In Deep, how do you talk to a Republican? It helps to know first how they think. We will spend the whole hour with best-selling science writer Chris Mooney on his new book, The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Don't Believe in Science. You can follow us on Twitter at InDeep Radio. We're on Facebook, too, as InDeep with Angie Cuero. Visit us online at InDeep.com for web extras this week from the political carnivals, Gotta Laugh, In the Raw, and more. Stick around for more In Deep. I'm Angie Cuero.
Yes, I know it's gonna get better, 'cause it almost always does. I can't say much about the who.
Thanks for tuning in this week to In Deep with Angie Cuero, a production of Talkback Studios. You can get more information about us at indeepradio.com. And while you're there, you can become a member and support our work. There's a link there to contact us, too, with any questions or feedback. We're developing a series on mental health issues in our country, especially in this economy, and we'd love to have you be part of that. Please send us your topic suggestions, your stories, and your questions through our website. Click the contact button at indeepradio.com. Join us again this time next week for two more hours of in-depth conversation. I'm Angie Carr. We'll see you then. You're listening to WPWC, 1480 AM, Dumfries, Virginia. We Act Radio, home of Washington's progressive working community.